The following Dharma talk was recorded in May 2013 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of five recordings from the retreat called Upadana, the Buddha's Teaching on Attachment, taught by Gloria Terania Ambrosia. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. The retreat teacher, Gloria Terania Ambrosia, is a student of the Western Forest Sangha and a lay Buddhist minister in association with Abhayagiri Buddhist Monastery in California. She serves as a core faculty member at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies and has been a Dharma teacher since 1990. More information on Terania can be found at www.bcbsdharma.org.
So I was glad to have that question this morning about eating, and it came late in the session and couldn't really do it justice. So I do want to talk a little bit more about that, but because it's so helpful. It's a great practice around mealtime. You know, you can really break through a lot of patterns, not just around eating, but patterns of attachment, generally speaking. But to do that, I got to lay a little groundwork and talk some about feeling, which was my plan for this morning anyway. And don't want to take up the whole session, and I'm sure that some of you are quite familiar with what the Buddha says about feeling and working with feeling. But I know some of you are new to it, and I do want to get us kind of all on the same page. But so the Buddha points to, and this is one of the foundations of mindfulness. It's one of the aggregates, and it's a key player in the process of waking up, this experience of feeling that comes with being a human being. And the way that the Buddha talks about it is very specific. It's not like emotional states, like we talk about our feelings. It's not that. It's actually a very visceral and somewhat physical, somewhat mental quality that arises and that comes with the territory of being a human being. You know, it's part of the hardware, really, of being a human being. So that in every single moment, just like all of the five aggregates are arising all of the time, there is some kind of feeling tone that we're experiencing. So the way that he explains it is that basically, you know, you got born and you get this body and mind, and they operate in certain ways. That from one moment to the next, from the time that we're born, literally until the time that we die, there is something happening at all of the, at one or another of the sense doors. There's either seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, or feeling. And it's like this boom, 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 boom. It's a constant bombardment. In fact, there's a technical term for it in formal retreat when you get to see at that level. It's called impingement. You know, you feel like you're being slammed one moment after the other by what is sensory contact, sensory input. And everything that, every moment of that has some kind of feeling tone associated with it. That means that momentarily one finds it pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And we miss a lot of that, but that's always there. It's not necessarily something that's very conscious. But, you know, up until that point, there's nothing to be done about it. This is all the hardware. This is all what goes with the territory. But what the Buddha is pointing to is that this feeling tone ends up being kind of the kicking off point for the states of greed, hatred, and delusion. And so it's very important, obviously, if you don't catch the feel, if you can't see that the feeling, then you have no, you can't get a leg up in intercepting greed, hatred, and delusion. It's like an automatic sequence. I find things pleasant. I like them. I want to get them. I find things unpleasant. I don't like them. I want to get away from them. I find things neither pleasant nor unpleasant. I stop paying attention. I check out, you know, or start looking for something that's more thrilling and exciting. So this is, you can see why it figures so prominently in the Buddhist teachings. For anybody who wishes to awaken the mind and heart, it is imperative that one begins to be sensitized to this feeling tone and to isolate it out against the backdrop of other things that are going on, to be able to be aware of that simple function of the, like I said, the hardware, the way that this body and mind operate. And I say that it's sort of a little bit of each body and mind because, I mean, the Buddha puts it squarely in the mind. You know, he says it's a mental event. But there's also some indications in the suttas and certainly the commentaries that it definitely, and in your experience, it definitely has a physical component to it. You know, when you see the fruit plate, you know, at breakfast and it's so beautifully put together and, you know, there's like you know, you can feel something, a lightness that happens in the heart. It's momentary. The next thing comes up right after it, but there it is, you know. And, if somebody makes a loud noise or, you get scared, this will happen. You know, the whole physical form even will contract around, painful, feeling. Neither is just kind of like a dullness of mind. So we want to be really attuned to this as practitioners, obviously because that's where all the, harm can begin, but it's also where the freedom can begin. And the Buddha said that in the teaching on dependent origination, he said that there's two main places where you can obstruct or take another course, obstruct the conditioned pattern or take another course. And one is being able to see that the point where feeling becomes a mental state, where feeling escalates, like pleasure escalates into greed, pain escalates into hatred. You know, you got to get a wedge in there. You got to slow it down enough. But the other point is, and this is important as practitioners, because as we begin to see that, then we're no longer ignorant. We understand the way the mind and the body operate, and now we've got some real tools to be able to work with it. And so to the extent that we really see and understand that process, we're much more likely to be able to get in there and exercise our options. That is what he's calling wisdom. You know, you're no longer ignorant. You're no longer not aware of what's going on here. So it's very, very important to be attuned to this process. Yeah? And you can see it no matter what's going on, in our lives. And, I think too, it has to be said that as practitioners, in a way, we have to acknowledge that, these kinds of impulses are rooted in our biology. I mean, this is reptilian brain stuff. You know, the idea to get towards what we need and away from what we don't want. That's survival mechanism. You know, we're hardwired for that and it serves a very good purpose. And we don't want to say there's nothing wrong about it. We just want to be aware of it. But, the difficulty is that, when we can't see it, it's almost as if now, following that impulse has become counter-evolutionary. You know, it was what you needed to do when there were saber-toothed tigers after you, you know. But now the saber-toothed tigers are our own ideas about the way we should and shouldn't be and things like that. And we're contracting around things that we don't need to be contracting around and expanding around things that don't serve us. So I think the point is that as a practitioner, you really have to be willing to take that on. We're actually literally taking on our biology, and trying to freeze frame things that are very much hardwired into the system, so that we have at least a pause, at least a moment where the conditioned karmic pattern isn't on automatic pilot, where you if you can just slow it down enough to get a wedge in there, then you've got some options. You can actually discern in the moment if this following this impulse is actually the path that serves me, you know. And we all know this. You know, you've all, I'm sure, been in situations where you can see where following that impulse doesn't serve. And yet, who hasn't had the feeling of not being able to stop doing it, you know, because that you meet your karma, you meet your pattern, and see how strong that is, you know. So, you know, the mindfulness of feeling, again, becomes a critical player when you understand what he's saying here. And it really gets our attention that you can try to pull out all the stops and just be increasingly sensitized to that progression. Contact at the sense doors, feelings of pleasure, pain, and neither, greed, hatred, and delusion, or non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. You know, these impulses are also hardwired. So we just want to slow it down enough to be able to see all of that and short-circuit. You know, that while the Buddha says that movement of mind is highly conditioned, it's not foreordained. And right in there is the promise of the potential for freedom. We can liberate this mind from the following those kinds of impulses, especially when we know that they don't serve us. So this is good stuff. And it's all seeable. It's all doable. You know, our job, again, is just to become aware. And to some extent, slow it down. But the awareness itself will slow it down, so that we can exercise the wisdom that we've garnered through practice. So you can see how this is such a key player when it comes to eating, and why eating can be such a rich area of practice, because when it comes to survival, the food is essential, and so the whole system goes into grasping mode around the possibility or the prospects of getting food. I mean, it's that primordial. Now add to that more complex cultural conditioning that has to do with getting the right kinds of foods, the things that we like, and all of that, and you can see the setup. So I remember one of the monks and I used to, well, before he was a monk, we used to just try to practice with eating and sit across the table. We did it mostly with ice cream, but you can do it with anything. And just try to watch what happens. It's like, okay, there it is. You see it. Maybe you smell it if it's another food. And you can feel the whole system getting aroused. It's ready, you know, for the hit. And if you sit there for a while and don't eat anything, just sit there looking at it, you know, watch what happens internally. It's like, come on, come on, come on, you know, let's get going here. You know, it's time to eat, you know. You can feel the push, can't you? And so just kind of working it like that, pause for a moment and see it. I mean, these are just some ideas of how you might work with it. You'll come up with your own. But then we would take a bite and try to be aware of that whole movement that reaches for it, and feel the intensity of the emotional states that'll be mixed in with that. You know, you're about to have pleasure. You know, the whole system's going bonkers, you know, and then you bring it up and put it on your tongue. And for a few seconds, if you're there for it, you can actually taste it. But then even you watch it, and even while it's still in your mouth, the consciousness moves very rapidly. You know, it's seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, feeling, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, feeling. You know, tasting, any one of those moments of consciousness where the experience that you're having actually registers is very fleeting. And so, definitely with tasting. So here's the food is in your mouth. And, if you're thinking about it or moving to get the next bite or off thinking about something else, you're not even tasting it. The tasting consciousness isn't even there, you know? So it's like everything's happening to give you the hit and you're not even getting it because the mind is off someplace else or doing something else, you know? It's fascinating to see. And I'm not saying it should be some other way. You know, the objective is not to, taste your food, you know, to keep tasting consciousness going. Good luck, you know? it doesn't quite happen that way. But it's more to see what's happening. And then, you know, that experience, like I was describing about the Starbucks at the airport with Ajahn, you know, over time watching like this, you start to see what a huge fuss we make about the hit. And then you compare the actual experience to that. And it necessarily, the impulses to get that hit are going to slowly dry up or weaken, you know, because the mind, as I said, the mind isn't stupid. It's going to begin to compare all that effort. Is that worth it? And all the energy and the focus that we put around food. It's, you know, there's a meditation that, the monks and nuns do every day right before they eat. And, It sounds, at first glance, it sounds, can sound depressing, but it's intended to get the whole experience of eating back in, the proper perspective. And, it goes like this. He says, wisely reflecting. If I'm going to wisely reflect about this process right here, wisely reflecting, I take this food. It's not for fun. It's not for pleasure. It's not for fattening. It's not for beautification. It's only for the maintenance and nourishment of my body, for keeping me healthy, for helping with the holy life. Thinking thus, I will allay hunger without overeating so that I may continue to live blamelessly and at ease. And certainly as a lay practitioner, we go, oh, poo, you know, he just took all the fun out of it. but that's not what he's saying at all. Food is fun. It is pleasant. And you can't do anything about that. You're going to enjoy it whether you like it or not, you know. So he's not saying don't enjoy it. He's just saying that when you do it for that purpose, and come on, let's be honest, we all do it, right? When you do it for that purpose, it's a setup for some difficulty. And just to evaluate and see if that's what you want to do. But not denying the pleasure of it. And it's fascinating. I mean, this is subtle stuff. And it's a fascinating distinction, if you ask me. Because I like food and I like to go out to lunch with gals, you know, and we like to go through all kinds of machinations to go to the right place. You know, we all do that. We're lay people. We haven't taken on a higher renunciation in that regard. And nor should we. That's all fine. But, you know, when it comes down to it, if it starts to get into this overdrive, you know, you can feel that happening. And, can you bring a note of levity to it? That's really what it's pointing to. And a lot of it is just predicated on being able to observe, like we do on retreat. We're not, the way that we eat on retreat and try to use retreat time to contemplate what's going on with eating, we're not saying that's the way you need to eat every time. It's just while you're on retreat, you're using that as a mechanism and experience for insight. So you're going to enjoy the meal, so don't worry about that, but just contemplate it while you're doing it. Yeah? So I hope that's helpful. I mean, I just couldn't get into as much of that because I was concerned about the cooks putting the food out and waiting for us this morning. But feeling and contemplation of what goes on with eating is critical stuff. Let me see if you have some comments or questions. Yeah, please. Yeah. Well, perhaps, and just to look at the food, though, and here's a carrot for you, speaking of carrots. It actually will be more enjoyable if you, can intercept the papancha about it. And if you can get it, that it is fleeting and it is momentary. You know, and that's why we get so crazy about it. It's, when you're eating, you are right up against impermanent suffering and non-self, and we don't want to see it. So you race, you know? Okay. Granted, the tasting is, I mean, this is not what you're actually thinking, but the effect is this. It's like, I can't hold on to the pleasure of this tasting. I better hurry up and get another one. And so, you know, one of the things that this monk and I would watch is like, not just the fleeting nature of the food, but how while it's still in there and the taste is already gone, the hand is moving towards the next bite. You know, that you watch the greed, watch the grasping happen. And so you, just trying to repeat that hit. Well, you see what I'm saying? That's major stuff to see because we're doing that all the time with everything. And food can be a great, eating can be a great thing, a way to learn that. So, wow, it is impermanent. If I try to make it not be that way, I'm suffering. I'm not the master of this. I can't control this. You're mixing it up, yeah. But just be careful not to use what he just said as a way to keep the greed going. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. That's great. And I hope you all heard that because it's a great example of what goes on with everything. It's things that are very simple become very complex because of the patterning of the mind, the things that the mind has to say about it and what it thinks about it and what it wants to do about it, the setup. I mean, Ajahn Sumedho says, ignorance complicates everything. It's a simple action, and you've made it very complex because all these issues are being brought to bear. It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, sometimes it's just, my first sense of it is that you get kind of drone-like. You just, you go on automatic pilot with, whatever food is on the plate, you have to eat it all. You know, and so you're not, that becomes the driving force. It's not what's actually happening in the body. So most of the time, myself, when I do that, that's what it is. It's just, you've just kind of glazed over and you're, going through the motions and getting it all in. Cause probably, most of us have that condition of eating everything on your plate, that kind of thing. So that's some of it, but also, you can offset that and by being able to be attuned to what's going on in the gut and say even in the throat when in the process of just reaching for the food and pulling it up. One can become very sensitized to there's like a feeling when you're full. But we don't, we're in such overdrive that we don't see it. And once you become more attuned to that, then that's the signal to stop. And sometimes that even takes some practice because I've certainly seen in myself, I can feel that. And then it's like the sense of, but everything's not eaten yet overrides that, you know, but just to stay in the actual experience of, when you've taken enough, the body knows. So the body is very, literal and simple. But you can know that the mind, you're following mental impulses at that point. You're following, ideas and views about what you should do instead of what, the body is actually telling you. And that all has to get worked out. You know, it's not, you have to first be aware of it and then, play with it to see what it's like to, actually do that. It feels very liberating. Say, wow, I'm full. And stop and put the rest of the food in the trash. I mean, my mind is, I have a greedy mind, and I began to notice, over the years of practicing, particularly at retreat centers where, you know, you're looking at this very, a lot, that when I would take the food, it'd be like, take this. In fact, I did this morning, and, take this bit of food, and then, the greedy mind, the fearful mind, goes back and takes just a little bit more. Right? And inevitably, what I've seen over the years is that first scoop is sort of like intuitive. It's like you sort of have a sense of knowing how much you need. And that's what appears on that first spoonful. And then this little thing goes back and gets more. That's the extra bit. And inevitably, if I happen to have the good fortune during that meal of being attuned to the full impulse, it's right at that point where that little bit of extra stuff is still on the plate. You know, I didn't need it. Yeah. It's primordial. It's you know, reptilian brain stuff. I don't think we can fully understand it. You know, I think fear is one of those states that we try to dissect it and make it something you can control, and like it's a mental event that you have some control over. But I don't think we do really. I think it's really hardwired and very linked with that those mechanisms, and as such, then it's a case more of working with it, you know, just being aware of it and and finding some kindness around it. It's like, ooh, I'm scared. I'm not going to get enough. Oh, you know. That's okay. But it's not true. And then you can be, if you accept it and embrace it, then you can work with it more reasonably. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's really good. And this is where, I mean, this may not sound very attractive, but this is where watching this, can dismantle that, because, the pleasure is so fleeting, and it's like the mind is looking for some kind of massive ultimate hit, and the actual experience of the pleasure that comes with it isn't really delivering that. And so you can see the setup. So why I say it might not seem very attractive is we have to get it that it's just pleasure associated with food. It's not this great pie in the sky. Now I've experienced the ultimate pleasure. And so, you know, the sense of you keep going for it and it never delivers and we don't see that. Then, you know, you can see the setup we're caught in. You know, we've got to be able to see and even mourn the loss of it. It's not really a loss because it's never been there. Nothing on the sensory level delivers in any ultimate way. And yet that's the conundrum. We're trying to make that not be true. So you have to keep going for it. Yeah. Addiction. Yeah, definitely. That's the way addiction operates. It's really not getting it. Not getting impermanence and suffering. Yeah. 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 And two, you can see what the mind does. It's like it takes this moment's pleasure and expects it and goes into this mode of wanting it again and wanting it to be as good and all of that. And that ends up being where we live. And we're looking for the hit that we just had. You know, and if you can dismantle all of this or see through it, then you can actually, you'll find that you'll rest more fully in that first visit to the restaurant. And, oh, that was so nice. And now it's over. That's it. I mean, believe me, I mean, I've explored this a lot because I tend to be a greedy type. And, I do find, everything's a lot more pleasant when I'm not grasping. You know, and when I'm getting its impermanent nature. Just be with it. Oh, that was great. You want to do it again? Maybe. I don't know. You know. You don't go to that necessarily. Like, we got to do this again next week. That kind of thing that comes up. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You see what the mind's doing? Oh yeah. Well, see, just keep seeing it. No, that's good. I mean, just keep seeing it and try. Maybe the first layer that you have to work on is beating up on yourself. That's the it's like the mind. It's actually unpleasant to be caught in that, and so then the mind is trying to get rid of that unpleasantness of rushing by hating it. It's ridiculous. Can you see it? Yeah, so work on that layer first. Try not to. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And then you can be with what you're actually seeing is the impulses of greed, hatred, of the leaning. You know, I used to, if I've told you this story before, forgive me, but, my mother had a lot of that. You know, she was just always, she had six kids and she was always the next thing, next thing, next thing, next thing. And then I would notice, like, when we'd go maybe to a restaurant or to church or something, she'd get out of the car and it'd be like she'd form us into a line almost with her gesture. She leads and everybody else follows. And, I was aware of it even as a child. I didn't like it. It's like, Mom, stay back here with us, you know? But she was leading. And then one time it happened with her as an adult. And after I started practicing, and I saw her get out of the car and start racing towards the restaurant, you know? And I had that impulse, Mom, you know? And then I thought, oh, my goodness, that's all. I know that. I know that. Leaning. And suddenly I understood her. I said to myself, wow, she's locked into the same thing I'm locked into. We're all locked into that. You know, it's the outcome of being born, in a deluded state, in an unawakened state. That's the way we operate. And our job is not to criticize it or hate it or try not to be that way. Then you're only compounding it. You just that locks you into the pattern. It's amazing. You see what the delusion of the unawakened mind. It keeps reaching for remedies that are compounding, not releasing. Right? And we want to see it. Yeah. That's right. And I bet you've had that experience. You know, just you've been watching something for a while, then one day all the conditions are right and it's not happening. Right. Yeah. I'm with you on that one. That's the leaning. You know. No, you got it. You nailed it. You're seeing it right. Yeah. But the thing that happens in the mind is, and I hear this so many times talking to meditators, it's like, well, okay, so then I see it, and then I feel it, right? Right? Yeah, you see it, you feel it. Yeah, yeah, and then what? And I guess the question is, what if there isn't any then what? What if that's it? You know, we keep coming back to relax, pay attention, and don't hate it. You keep coming back to that. The basic instruction that you get the first time on a meditation retreat, and it's all right there. It is all right there. and trust. I guess what comes over time is that you begin to trust that, it's almost as if the whole system, being a human being, is very fortunate because the whole system is hardwired for freedom. It's like we just need to feed up this mind, the way I put it is the cleanest data that you can. So the clean data would be what you see yourself doing and the feeling associated with it, the pain when you get caught in it, the freedom when you don't, that kind of thing. That's the good clean data. If the old ways get engaged, then you try to fix that. And now your data isn't clean anymore. You've contaminated it with some ideas about who you need to be, what you need to become, where you need to go. Now you're just completely right back in the soup. Yeah? So it's tricky, and give it to ourselves. I think we have to give it to ourselves. It takes a while to trust the process of practice. This is the process of practice. You may not, do it and be able to really do it for 5 or 10 years. Well, it's just a compliment. It's the same. It's the same thing, but the reverse. The greed is the grabbing hold of the pleasure. The aversive state is the grabbing hold of the pain. So that the mind, when we're caught in some form of difficulty, your example is a good one. The movement of the mind to change it, to fix it, to do something about it. This is all coming out of resistance and rejection and aversion to what is. Yeah. So arises in a very highly conditioned way, for some of us, for all of us, really. But some are just more dominantly one and not the other. So, I mean, if you want to give me an example, I could walk you through it, but. That's right. That's right. Yeah, just notice it. That's right. That's right. And some of it's driven by fear. Like, some people on retreat get very anxious around getting the right kinds of foods, the foods that they think they need to nourish them. And to see that there's a mechanism that's operating there. I don't want this. I don't want that. I don't want this. I need this. I need this. I need this. That kind of thing. Yeah. Maybe you've seen that. Or with people, you see aversion a lot. You know, you enter a room full of people and, notice how quickly, even without interacting with them, based on very little information, one is starting to lean towards some, away from others and, not even notice others. Interesting. Yeah. Well, some of it happens, some of wise effort happens automatically as a consequence of insight. You know, so you'll find yourself just doing that quite naturally. And I love that, you know, where you see yourself moving away from things that are not, helpful, moving towards things that are. That's where you've actually freed up the pleasure and pain principle to sort of work in your interests in your own behalf. But, I mean, you bring up a good point that I tend to be much more inclined to work with the insight factor, and being there for the experience and letting the experience, teach me, right? But there is also, making determinations, you know, to resolve to free yourself from difficult states and to keep them at bay. To resolve to cultivate skillful states and to sustain them if they come up. These are the four great efforts. And for myself, I mean, I don't know how you hold that. Maybe you can tell me, but I sort of hold that in my mind as a core basic determination. That's what I'm about as a practitioner. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean that when an unskillful state comes up, I have to get in there and manipulate that in some way. It may mean that working to free myself of that means what I have to do right there and then is muster all the relaxation and mindfulness that I can so that I can feel it. You know what I mean? So it's just a slightly subtler way, but by all means, you work with resolve. You work with making determinations to rid ourselves of some states and cultivate others. So I don't know if that's helpful. I work with it in kind of a subtle way. Yeah. Yeah, please. Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. It is very subtle stuff. It's deep. It's profoundly experiential. And so, but the intellect keeps wanting to, fix it and do something about it. So, and let's be honest, there's things in the Buddhist teachings that seem to trigger that stuff. Like you start talking about the five hindrances, you know, and like, who wants them? What do I have to do to get rid of them? You know? And so the whole system goes into overdrive again, trying to figure out ways to pounce. Well, what if the way that we get free of them is to, notice what, since you can't seem to get a leg up anyway and to prevent their arising, in most situations, how about being there when they arise and taking that in? And being sensitized to what it's like and trust. Again, trust that process. I mean, I misspoke there. There are things you can do to prevent them arising, which is really, establish and sustain yourself in a calm and mindful state. But, you know, good luck. You know, I said this once when we went to Thailand and we got the opportunity to ask a lot of questions of the senior monks in the various monasteries. You know, I had just come from being with some friends who were into this non-dual stuff, you know, and their idea was, well, you just get the state and you stay there, you know. So yeah, you know, something to that. I like that. I can understand what they're saying. But anyway, I asked the monk, I said, so what about that? You know, I just find presence of mind and stay there. And he said, that's right. That's great. But can you do it? So you see the dilemma. You got to work both ends of the equation. Oh, it's a good one. How do you handle panhandlers and hitchhikers? I know that one. That's up to you. I mean, these are good ones to play with. I'll just tell you a story. I have a lot of stories, obviously. But I often teach in Philadelphia. And when I'm there, I go over to this group in New Jersey when I'm there. And you have to cross over the Ben Franklin Bridge. Well, as you enter the bridge, there's a whole line of, people with signs and baskets and handouts and everybody wanting something. And the city's never really been able to get on top of it. There's just a whole string of panhandlers there. For months, I would go back and forth over this bridge a couple times a week and go, light, turn green, turn green, turn green, you know, just to try to, can I get in the lane away from them? Can the traffic keep moving so I don't have to deal with this? You know, because the mind is like, it doesn't know what to do. It's not that I don't care. Do you know what I mean? But I was watching it because I thought, oh, God, you know, this is pretty hateful stuff. You know, what's going on here? But I could see it wasn't that I didn't care. It's that I didn't know what to do. I don't know what to do. They you give them the money and people say, well, then they just go get liquor and drugs. And am I helping? All that, you know? And then finally I just said, oh, phooey. And I made I got an envelope and just put a bunch of dollar bills in it. And I kept it in the seat next to me. And every time I went past somebody, I said, oh, here you go. Here you go. Oh, yeah, have a nice day. Here you go. Have a nice day. Great. You know, it was so much more pleasant. It was so great. And then I suddenly started loving going over that bridge, you know. yeah, right. Exactly. I wasn't giving them 20s and 5s. And, but anyway, it was something. And it was like that somebody is in need. Or at least they think they're in need. And I can't discern, you know? What do I know about what's going on in their mind? They think they're in need. Let me, respond. You know, I was just reading the signs around here. You know, I don't know if you read what's going on in this, these stained glass, but basically it's all about supporting the corporal needs of people, to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to minister to the sick, you know? Feels good. And in the end, that's what it comes down to. The mind is trying to sort out what's going on in the external world and how best to deal with it. But in the end, in terms of liberation, the only thing that matters is what's happening in this heart. And I didn't like the contracted feeling of refusing to give compared to how good it felt to give. Yeah, that's nice too. Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah. But it's interesting that you mentioned that too, because, when you talk to the monks and nuns about when they go on alms round, you know, they're alms mendicants. That's the way the Buddha set it up. And so they walk through town with their bowls, ready to receive. And, some of the stories they tell is amazing. You know, people go, well, what's this all about? You know, and they say, well, they explain. That's what it's about. And then, oh, I can get behind that. Wait right here, you know, run into the grocery store and get a sandwich and come out and put it in. It's the way that they frame it is one is setting up the conditions for generosity to arise. And, it's brilliant. If you ask me. The Buddha setting it up that way is absolutely brilliant. You know, the monks and nuns have their own way of having to give rise to generosity, but this is a way for them to be a vehicle for that in the culture. And so then you start to think about the panhandlers and the what have you that way. Let's just sit for a few minutes and we'll go and do some walking.